In Hebrews chapter 1, first four verses, we read this. I'm reading from the English Standard Version today, as I usually do. It says, "Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed the heir of all things, through whom also He created the world." That's the phrase I want to focus on right there. "Through whom He also created the world." Notice the singular world. Verse 3 says, "He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature, and He upholds the universe," or all things, as it is in the KJV and other translations, "by the word of His power, after making purification for sins." Thank you. "He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, having become as much superior to angels as the name He has inherited is more excellent than theirs." I want to focus again, as I mentioned earlier, on that latter part of verse 2, "through whom He," that is God, "created the world." Now, what do you think of when you hear that expression, "God created the world"? Of course, it's through the agency of the Son, He created the world. You probably think of Genesis 1, the creation narrative. You probably remember some of the passages from Genesis 1 of how He created a firmament, separated the waters from the waters, thus creating an atmosphere. How He rolled back, or He gathered the waters into one place, and the dry land appeared. Then He caused the fish to be. He brought in the fish and the the land beast and the birds of the air, and so on. So you may be thinking in those terms. But I'd like to read this same verse, or this part of the verse, verse 2, the latter part of verse 2, and some of the other, a couple of other translations. It says in the New International Version, "through whom He also made the universe." When you hear that, you think, oh, look at verse 1. "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." You think all things, everything, the whole universe. And here we're told that He did so through the agency of the Son. But the New Revised Standard Version says, "through whom He also created the worlds," plural, "the worlds." What do you mean, the worlds? Multiple worlds? Are they talking about Earth, you know, Mars, Venus, Neptune? Are there other worlds that have, there are planets out there that have life? You know, you could take that, you could send that verse into Ancient Aliens, the TV series, and they could probably make something of it. But it says, "through whom He created the world." So if you look up all the different translations, you would find that the overwhelming vast majority of the English translations use one of those three words, either world or the plural worlds or the universe. So which is it, and what exactly does He mean here? If you check and look at Young's literal translation, however, you see something different. And it is a literal translation. It's also the same in the literal standard version. And the word, instead of worlds or universe or world in the singular, it is correctly translated, because the word is aionos or ionos in the Greek, and it means ages. So it says that in these last days He has spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed the heir of all things, through whom also He created the ages. Now, what in the world does that mean? How do you create ages? And how did God create the ages? We think of creation, we think in terms of God having created planet Earth, and of course the whole universe, calling matter into existence from nothing and forming, shaping it, and giving it its characteristics, its properties. And that's what we think of that as creation. But I'm not so sure that's the way the Hebrews thought of it. That's not the Hebrew thought. In thinking about creating the world means He created not only the world, but the things in it and the things that would come about across the ages. And this is really what He has in mind here, I believe. I'd like to read this section here from verse 2 in the Amplified Bible Classic Edition. Now remember, this is Amplified Bible. And I think it captures what is intended here. It says, but in the last of these days he has spoken to us in the person of a son, whom he appointed heir and lawful owner of all things, also by and through whom he created the worlds and the reaches of space and the ages of time. Now that's an amplification for sure, isn't it? He made, produced, built, operated, and arranged them in order. So I think the amplified version here is capturing the intent of this expression, through whom he also created the ages. In other words, he ordered these things. It shows that the writer of Hebrews was not a deist. You know what deism is, or what a deist is. Some of the founding fathers were allegedly deists, and what that means simply is, at least in classical deism, is that God created this universe. He wound it up, as it were, like winding up a clock, like a clockmaker would do, and he's letting it run. And basically, he's gone off into another room. He has nothing to do with it. He lets it run on its own. That's usually the way deists see things, and that's the way they would explain how you can have God on the one hand creating the heavens and the earth, and yet you can have all of these things going on, from evil to good to all. It's all, you know, it runs the gamut of things that we see going on in this world. So God just basically lets it run and has nothing to do with forming its future. That's what's deism. But then on the other hand, you have in the Reformed tradition, and this is made up largely of Calvinists, and people who have carried this Augustinian thought, which can actually be traced back to Greek philosophy, and that is that that God has decreed all things, meaning everything that will ever happen. Even some grasshopper out here that jumps from one leaf to the other, that was in the eternal decree from eternity. Every breath of air you take, every sin you commit, in fact, every good deed you do, everything was in the divine decree, and all of it was prearranged from all eternity, and that is how he creates the ages. Of course, that's either of those positions, I maintain, is certainly not biblical. Deism is not biblical. You see it right here in this verse. Deism is not biblical. In other words, God didn't just wind up the universe and now he's departed from it, basically has nothing else to do with it. He's letting it run on its own. He does have something to do with it. On the other hand, you have this other extreme where God has preordained everything that ever happens. You run into some big problems with that, because you have, on the one hand, God is not the author of evil. He does not create human evil, meaning moral evil. He creates evil in the sense of calamity, but not moral evil. And yet here he has decreed all things. How do you reconcile that? It's hard to reconcile, isn't it? I've heard Calvinists attempt to do it, but they end up, they haven't convinced me yet, put it that way. So what this means is that simply that God, through the agency of the Son, arranges, orders, and manages major events of the unfolding of time in order to bring about the goal of creation. That's what it means. Simple as that. And he does it without turning human beings into robots in order to carry out his divine will. In other words, everything I do was not decreed from eternity. Or everything, each of us individually, the minutiae, it's not there. But as far as the major events, in order to control history, to move history in a certain direction and bring it to its goal, that is what he has ordered and arranged and what he is managing. That's what it means, as simple as that. But you have all kinds of room there for human free moral agency, for people to do good deeds and bad deeds, to make mistakes, to repent of their mistakes, and so on. To reject the gospel, to receive the gospel. All kinds of room is within that overall flow of history as directed by God for these things to happen. In other words, what this means is that it means that in the day of judgment, the Pharaoh of the Exodus, cannot say, I had no choice in the matter. Can't say that. You hardened my heart, says so in your Bible. You hardened my heart. You caused me to bring evil upon your people, so why are you now blaming me? He can't claim that. You know why? Because how did God harden his heart? Did he reach inside and throw a switch somehow and cause Pharaoh to say, oh, I'm not going to do that now? And then he throws another switch, oh, I am going to do it now, and I'm not. Did he control Pharaoh that way? Did he reach in there and cause Pharaoh to desire certain things at certain times and desire other things at other times? No, what he did was he sent Moses to him. You know, he did not directly harden his heart. He said, I'm going to send you, and you're going to tell him to let the people go. How do you think a proud king is going to respond to someone like that coming and saying, this is what you will do? He's going to harden himself. So God indirectly hardened his heart. Also, he indirectly hardened his heart by sending on and taking off the plagues. At certain points, Pharaoh had had enough. All the people surrounding him says, let them go. We can't survive this. And he finally, okay, I'll let the people go. Then when the plague is lifted, what happens? In response to that, Pharaoh hardens himself again. So God hardened Pharaoh's heart, but he did so indirectly. So he didn't have to reach down and cause Pharaoh to be a bad person. Pharaoh was already a bad person. He already had the qualities of character he had, and God simply manipulated the environment. He controlled the environment. He managed and ordered and arranged the environment to cause the desired outcome. That's the way it works. So in the day of judgment, Pharaoh can't make that claim. Neither can Judas. Judas cannot say, look, I was predestined to this role. You ordained it from eternity, and I had no choice in the matter. But, you know, Judas did have a choice. He did have a choice. Well, you read the text, and sometimes you get the impression that he's just fulfilling this prophecy that was specifically about him. But if you really examine those prophecies that are applied to Judas, what you find there is that they're not specifically about Judas. They're just about a particular kind of person. And here you find them being applied to Judas because Judas chose to be that kind of person. So God used the situation, ordered and arranged and managed so as to bring about the crucifixion at a certain time and in a certain place. Now, we see God ordering and managing the ages of this world, the flow of time, and the history of human beings. And go back, you know, we looked at it before in Genesis 6. Let's look at the review, just a few verses out of Genesis 6 to show what happened back then when God chose to flood the world. And there's some interesting things in the text that long ago led me to question some of these ideas, common ideas about classical theism. In Genesis chapter 6, you know what, the iniquity had become so bad, wickedness had come to the level now that God was going to take action. Let's just take up the account in verse 5. It says, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Now, let me ask you a question before we read the next verse. Do you think God had decreed from all eternity that this would take place? That man would have this kind of evil in his heart? If he did, then certainly he would not have any kind of emotion about it, would he? He would not have any particular kind of feeling about it, would he? Because after all, if he decreed it from eternity, not just at some point in time, but from eternity, like the Augustinians tell us, if that is what's going on, then certainly God wouldn't be expressing any disappointment, because what is happening is what he always knew would happen. Isn't that correct? But it says here in verse 6, and the Lord was sorry that he made man on the earth. Now, if you're Augustinian, you cannot take that literally. God cannot be sorry about anything because God is impassible. He does not experience emotion. But this tells us he was sorry that he had made man on the earth. So you have to dismiss this as an anthropopathism. There's anthropomorphisms where God is presented with human characteristics. And when God is presented with human passions or emotions, that's called an anthropopathism. And this is what was, this verse is said to be an anthropopathism, which means that it's not to be taken literally as it states here. It says, and it grieved him to his heart. Oh, no, no, God doesn't grieve. He cannot experience emotion if you're an Augustinian. But, you know, if you're Hebrew, or if you understand Scripture the way a Hebrew normally would, then you see God as a very interactive God that does respond to humans, and He does have emotion, and He does become sorry at times, and He becomes joyful at times over the behavior of His children, and He actually listens to prayers, and sometimes He changes His mind. That's not classical theism, but I say that is biblical theism. And that's exactly the way Noah, Moses, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, and Jesus Christ Himself understood God in those terms. So the God of the Bible, in my opinion, is quite different from the God of classical theism. It says, so the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the land, from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them. I am sorry that I have made them. So again, this is the text just simply says this, showing that God does experience emotion. He does interact with human beings, and He is moved by them one way or the other, by their behavior. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. We won't read the rest of it. You know the story. God destroyed the earth, and the reason He destroyed it, as it tells us very plainly, was because of all the violence and corruption that was in the earth. And so God made that decision. So here you see God. He could have let things run along as they were going, and it would only become much worse. But what you see is an intervention here, and He is controlling, He is shaping the ages. And then you get to the other side of the flood. You see in chapter 11, we're not going to read this, I'll just refer to them again as I did in a previous sermon. You see the Tower of Babel. Once again, you see history beginning to flow in a certain direction because you have this tower being built, you have this one civilization, and God says nothing will be impossible to them. He's not saying that they'll have great technological achievements before you know it, nothing like that. What He's saying is that they'll go right back to doing what they were doing before the flood. And they were already beginning to be in rebellion against Him as they had been before the flood. And what happens? Once again, God intervenes and He changes the course of history. So what does this mean? What does this mean to us? It means very simply that God does not just let things, always let things run, let the universe unfold as it would without any intervention. Instead, He intervenes, He changes the course of history in order to bring history, the history of humankind, keep it going in a certain direction and bring it to its ultimate goal. Sorry about that. Got a lot of throat things going on here, a lot of throat congestion going on. And you see it as you continue on through the different accounts. You see it in the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, once again, He is controlling history, but not micromanaging all the details. It's very important to understand that. So He is controlling the flow of human history in order to bring it to a certain conclusion. So you see it in Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God lets people do what people do. He lets them make foolish choices. Even the people He's working with made some very foolish choices along the way. And He still intervenes and controls the direction of the flow of history. And so that it will reach the events, so it will continue to go in a certain direction. Well, let's go on over to chapter 37, Genesis 37. I want to take a look at one example in particular. The example of Joseph in Genesis 37. And it's very interesting what begins to happen here. You have the story of course, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Jacob's sons. And now you have his youngest son, who is Joseph, and because he's the child of his old age, well, guess what? He's the favorite. Or at least he treats him differently from the other sons. And what sometimes happens in families when the younger child gets all the attention, the older ones get a little bit jealous perhaps. And so Jacob is fond of Joseph. He even makes him this coat of many colors. his brothers. It makes it very clear they're jealous of him. Then something happens. God begins working with Joseph in a certain way, and this only worsens the situation. Look what happens in verse 4. But so when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. Now this is what happened. It even worsened that situation. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." Now they already hated him, jealous of him. How do you think that made them feel? Oh, we like him now. Oh, no. His brother said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more from his dream, for his dreams and for his words. But that was not the end of it. Said, then Joseph dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream." And I'm sure they were just eager to hear it and said, "Oh boy, let's hear it." It says, "Behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?" So even his father was taken back a little bit by it. And yet, it goes on saying, his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. And of course, before his death, his father will see this come to pass. And then you know the story, I'm sure, about how what happened with the brothers. The brothers were out pasturing their father's flock, and he assumed they were in Shechem, a place called Shechem, and he sent Joseph to them. And Joseph went. He couldn't find them, but he eventually found them in a place called Dothan. Then verse 18 says, "They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to," guess what? "Kill him." Well, that shows you how deep the hatred was. Now, these are the fathers of God's covenant nation. Understand that. Of the elect nation, Israel. They gave their names to the tribes making up the nation of Israel, God's covenant people. It sounds like they're not off to a good start, doesn't it? But anyway, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. I guess he's got a few more dreams for us. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal had devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, now I submit that God is acting through Reuben, because here they're going in a certain direction. They're going to commit a certain act, and it definitely would affect history, their own history, not just Joseph's, the history of the whole family. But here Reuben, then, he hears this, and he rescued him out of his hand, saying, "Let us not take his life." So it kind of takes a little turn there. However, they're still going to treat him rather badly. And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Cast him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of the robe of many colors that he wore, and they took him and cast him into the pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a cavern of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, and their camels having gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry down to Egypt. Then Judah, here's another of the brothers, Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother?" So he had a better idea too. "And conceal his blood. Come, let us sell him." That's a good idea now. "Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." So at least that's a somewhat of a better idea, a little more mercy there, a little more acknowledgement of the fact that, hey, this is our brother. We can't do this to him. And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders, Midianites and Ishmaelites were basically the same people. They intermarried with each other. They came from the same forebears. The traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. So that's how he got to Egypt. And then when Reuben returned to the pit and saw Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brother and said, "The boy is gone, and where shall I go?" Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat, dipped the robe in blood. They took it, of course, to Jacob and told him that the boy was dead. Of course, that's that in itself. Just that Jacob, of course, grieved deeply for his son. But you can see these were bad people. They just were. I don't know any other way to describe it. They're bad people. They're doing bad things here. And yet you see God intervening and doing what? He's restraining evil, isn't he? That's how God controls these situations. He lets evil people be evil, but from time to time he intervenes, he restrains the evil. And sometimes he then, as we shall see, he removes those restraints and lets evil have its way. So it's not a matter of God decreeing all things from all eternity. It's a matter of God letting things go, as the deist would say, letting things go on as they naturally and normally would, with human beings doing what human beings would do, and then reaching in from time to time to restrain evil or to let evil have its way, remove the restraints, and keep history flowing in a certain direction in order to bring it to its ultimate goal. That's what we see going on right here. And of course, you will recall that God had told Abraham long ago that his descendants would find themselves in a strange land. Well, here it is right here. This is how they got there. As you continue on through the story, we won't take the time to read it all, but you know what happens. In chapter 42, Joseph's brothers go to Egypt because they have heard that grain is for sale there. And why would they be interested in that? Because there was a famine in the land. It was during that 7 years of famine, and thanks to Joseph's plan. And by this time, by the way, Joseph, you know, you read the story of Joseph. He went through his trials and tribulations in Egypt. It runs the gamut, the things that he experienced from bad to worse, all the way to actually exercising power and being recognized as a very powerful person in the government in Egypt. And because of his plan, Egypt had plenty during those 7 years of famine. But now then, guess who comes knocking on the door, as it were? Joseph's brothers. And what are they looking for? Food. It's interesting, isn't it, how this all turns out. Joseph has the food. He draws them, as it were, from the land of Canaan to Egypt so that they can get their supplies. And of course, that's where they find him. And you can imagine how they must feel. Well, you read the text, you can see that for yourself. But here they show up there in order to get the grain. But again, thanks to Joseph's plan, there's something there for them. The key verse that I want to focus on, though, skip on over to chapter 50. This is after Jacob's death. You know the story here of how Joseph lets the brothers and their families, he actually makes provisions for them because of his status in Egypt. He's able to do this. And so his father Jacob and all of their family, the brothers' families, come there and they take up residence. And that's how Israel wound up in Egypt to begin with. So there they are with their provisions, and it's all thanks to Joseph, whom they and originally intended to put to death, but now because they sold him, and now he wound up in Egypt, because of their mistreatment in one sense, now then they're rescued. You can see how this whole thing is a type of Jesus Christ, can't you? Joseph serves as a type of Christ. His own people killed him, along with the Romans and others, and yet he is the one who provides salvation for the whole house. So you see the type of Christ here very clearly. But over in chapter 50 is what I want to focus on. And let's look and begin and break into the account there in verse 15. It says, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, this is obviously after Joseph had, or after Jacob had died, it may be that Joseph, they said, it may be that Joseph will hate us. So they're thinking maybe Jacob being alive was the only thing keeping him from taking vengeance on us, because he surely hasn't forgotten what we did to him. So it may be that he wants to pay us back for all the evil we did to him. So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father gave this command before he died. To say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. Joseph wept when he spoke to him, when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him. Well, that old sheaf is standing pretty tall now, isn't it? Fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? So Joseph knows that there's a plan in place here, that God has permitted evil, and yet he has also restrained evil to keep things moving in a certain direction, to bring them to this point right here. As for you, and this is the verse I want to focus on, you meant evil against me. But God meant it for good. Does not mean, as we have seen, does not mean that God put the evil in their hearts. They did that themselves. They already had it. But what it does mean is that out of this whole situation, God took this evil that you did and he turned it into good. Because he's able to restrain evil and he's able to lift the restraints at key points in order to keep things going as he wants them to go. It's as simple as that. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. And of course, we think of Jesus Christ, his persecutors, whether you're talking about the Jews, his own brethren, the Romans, or anyone else who was involved, they meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. So that's how you can have a sacrifice be simultaneously a murder. They murdered Jesus Christ. It was a grisly crime, a horrendous sin, and yet at the same time, it was a pleasing aroma, a sacrifice to God on behalf of God's people. So you see from this how that can be, there can be such a thing. What men mean for evil, God means for good. He says, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So they would have perhaps perished in the famine had it not been for all that happened here. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So that's quite a story there, but it's instructive to us because it shows how that God, in spite of human evil, is able to use that and able to order and arrange and manage that in order to keep history flowing in a certain direction and bring ultimately creation to its full, to the fulfillment of its purpose. So you see this going on in these various stages and steps right here. Now, I'd like to go with that in mind. Let's go over to Acts 4, Acts the 4th chapter. And we see the same principle taking place. It doesn't say it, but now that we've established the principle of how that God restrains through intervention, and in this case, he restrained evil through the intervention of Reuben. He uses agents, whether human agents or in some cases angelic agents. Any agent he chooses, he can use to restrain evil or to lift the restraints. And so in this case, he used Reuben. Then Reuben acted as God's agent, not in creating evil, but in restraining it so that the desired end would come about. So we can conclude that from that, then when we read something like Acts chapter 4, you see the same thing going on. In Acts chapter 4, Peter and John are brought before the chief priests and the captains of the temple and the Sadducees, they're all upset because they're talking about the resurrection. The Sadducees didn't believe in that. So they're before the council, and of course they're threatened. And naturally, when you're threatened by, you know, the authorities, sometimes there may be an inclination to be a little bit fearful. But they said, we must obey God rather than men, and then they went back to their own company. Let's read what happens there in verse 23, what the church did. Said, when they were released, they went to their friends, that's the church, the assembly, and reported what the chief priests and the elders had said to them. This was Peter and John. And when they heard it, this is when the church, the people of the church, heard it. They lifted their voices together, no doubt someone leading in this prayer, but they lifted their voices together to God and said, Sovereign Lord, Sovereign Lord. What, the word sovereign, what does that indicate? That He is high above all, that nothing is outside His control. That He's capable of reaching in and moving things in the way He wants them to move. He's sovereign. Just like a king is sovereign over his kingdom, he directs where the kingdom is going, what the kingdom does, what the armies do. He directs everything. And so God is the sovereign Lord who made the heaven and the earth, sees over the heaven and earth and the sea and everything in them, who through the mouth of our father David, your servant, said by the Holy Spirit, and this is from Psalm 2, says, why do the Gentiles rage? Notice the four groups that he mentions here. Why did the Gentiles rage, and the peoples, that's the second group, plot in vain? The kings, that's the third, of the earth set themselves, and the rulers, that's the fourth, were gathered together against the Lord and against His anointed, the Messiah, in other words. The Lord and the Davidic king, Yahweh and the Davidic king. For truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod, there's your king, and Pontius Pilate, there's your ruler, along with the Gentiles, that's the Romans in general, and the peoples of Israel, there's the peoples, there's the four groups named right there. So what they see in this psalm, Psalm 2, they see it finding a fulfillment. In other words, what happened there in the crucifixion of Jesus fills up the meaning of that psalm, and they recognize that. So they and it says, and this is the point I wanted to focus on, though, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. He's not saying that He predestined a murder. He put within the people, their hearts, the spirit of murder so that they would carry out His plan. No, they did that themselves. What He did is predestined the plan itself. And how did He do that? Again, not by causing people to become evil or reaching in there and throwing a switch and said, you used to be good, but today you're evil, and you will carry out My plans as an evil person. And tomorrow maybe I'll throw the switch and you won't be so bad anymore. No, that's not the way it works. Not the way it works at all. What He does is he manages these events in such a way as to let evil do what evil does, but in some cases He restrains it and then He releases it. He removes the restraints. That's how it's done. So, you know, you think, well, what about Judas? What about all these people? Pontius Pilate, the Jews of that day who were out there in the crowd saying, crucify Him, crucify Him. If all of this was predestined, then it seems to me like God is the guilty party and not them. Some people come to that conclusion. No, what God is doing, again, it's their evil. He's just restraining at certain points, and He's lifting the restraints at other points. They're always candidates. There were always, throughout the ministry of Jesus, there were always candidates who would do the job, ready and willing to do the job. How many times did they threaten to stone Him? You remember when He slipped through the crowd to get away from them? They were going to kill Him. They're going to throw Him off a cliff at one point. Another time they were going to stone Him. He would always manage to get away. He'd hide Himself. It wasn't His time yet, and He knew it. But there were always plenty of people who could do the job. They wanted to murder Him. They would have done it much sooner had God not put the restraints there. But when the time came, at Passover season, that he would fulfill the meaning of that feast in a way that, what it had pointed to the whole time, then he lifted those restraints. At that point, Judas did what Judas did, what Judas wanted to do all along, and the others did what they did. And it happened right at the right time. So that's how God operates in those. He's not to be blamed for the evil of others. He lets them be evil, but he sometimes restrains what they're able to do in order to either put the brakes on or speed up the plan to make it come about the way he wishes it to come about. So this is what's going on here. This is what went on with the crucifixion of Jesus. And I think it's very clear in the text. So we can't look at those texts about Judas Iscariot and say, well, the poor guy didn't have any choice. I've heard people say that. He was predestined to do that. He just didn't have any choice. But he did. He did. And if he had not done it, had he made the right choice and chosen to back out of all that and not gone along with it, then somebody else would have stepped up. If you go back and look at the prophecy, it doesn't have to be Judas. It could have been any number of people. So you see how God is working and bringing about his plan, and how he actually allows us, human beings, to be substantially free. We're substantially free as far as our moral agency is concerned. And how we can't throw his plan out of kilter. We can't interrupt it and cause it to fail. You see the same thing back in Matthew 24. In Matthew 24, this is the Olivet prophecy. And whether you take this as a reference to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 or to the end time, it doesn't matter because the principle is the same. You notice what happens here, what he says here, says in verse 15, so when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea, not talking about South America, obviously, but those in Judea flee to the mountains. Because obviously something terrible is coming upon Judea at this point. Again, whether it's the 70 AD event or whether it's something in the end time, it doesn't really matter. We'll read down to the main point I want to get at here. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house, and let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, the women who are pregnant, and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight be not in the winter on the Sabbath day. For then there will be great tribulation, such as was not from the beginning of the world, even till now, no, never will be. So, in other words, he's saying, get out of Judea, because something like nothing else that's ever happened there is going to happen. And you better get out of there. The emphasis here is don't gather your things. When you see this abomination of desolation, however you wish to interpret that, when you see it, then it's time to go and don't look back. And he goes on to say this, and if those days had not been cut short, no human being or no flesh would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days were cut short. In other words, God at some point, whether you're talking again, AD 70, or whether you're talking or actually the late 60s, or whether you're talking in the end time, God, what does he do? He restrains the evil. Now, if you apply this to AD 70, the same principle, or 66 through 70, what happened was when General Titus and the Roman armies besieged Jerusalem, and of course, all kinds of horrible things were going on in there because the zealots had already burned up their grain supply, and now then they were under siege and they didn't have food. And you know what happens when people don't have food and they can't get out? Bad things start to happen, including, you know, when someone dies, cannibalism. That sort of thing was actually going on in Jerusalem at that time. And when the siege, this ended in the destruction of the temple. It was a horrendous time of tribulation for Jerusalem at that point. And so many thousands were killed by the Romans. And then Titus originally wanted to end the Jewish problem once and for all. He was going to pursue those who had left, and that would include the Nazarenes, the Hebrew, the Jewish Christians that had gone to Pella. He would have pursued them and destroyed them all, thus ending the so-called Jewish problem once and for all. But that plan was cut short. So those days were short. So God intervenes and restrains evil for his own purposes. In this case, in the case of AD 70, he protected the elect who had fled Jerusalem before that particular tribulation took place. As far as the end time, that remains to be seen exactly how all that plays out. But again, the point is that sometimes God intercedes and intervenes, and he restrains the evil that is taking place for the benefit of his people, again, so as to keep things moving in a certain direction. You see this same thing in 2 Thessalonians. I'm not going to turn there. I'm just going to refer you to it. It speaks of the man of sin, the son of perdition. In other words, this Antichrist figure. The concern here was that Christ may have already returned. The day of the Lord has already happened. And Paul says, oh, no, it hasn't happened yet. Don't worry about that. It's not going to happen until the man of sin appears. He says the mystery of lawlessness is already at work, and it'll continue to work until this man of sin, this man of lawlessness, appears. And then, of course, we recognize that as a final Antichrist figure. Now, people say, is this Antichrist, this final Antichrist, has he been born yet? Well, he was born in every generation, or someone who would fulfill that role if God allowed it to happen. It doesn't have to be a specific individual. But he says the mystery of lawlessness is already at work, and it says, and he who restrains shall restrain until he's taken out of the way. So what does that mean? Paul is saying that even in his day, the mystery of lawlessness was already at work and was being restrained. And then eventually, whatever it is that is restraining that God has in place, whether angelic beings or maybe some emperor or some other agent, whatever is restraining will be moved out of the way. In other words, the restraints will be lifted, and then lawlessness will have its full expression. That's when the man of lawlessness will appear. So you see, once again, how God intervenes and he restrains or he lifts those restraints in order to move history in a certain direction. So it's not as if there is a prophesied individual and it must be that particular individual to fulfill this role. You think, poor guy, it was just terrible that he had to be the one. What if you're born and you realize you'd feel terribly unlucky, wouldn't you? No, you're going to be the Antichrist. But I don't think that's the way it works. Don't think that's the way it works at all. There are many Antichrists out there, and they're being restrained. The time will come when the restraints will be lifted, and the mystery of lawlessness will come to full expression. The man of sin will appear, and then you can know that Christ is at the door. He's ready to intervene and cut it all short to end the reign of this Antichrist figure. In Isaiah chapter 46, I'll just turn back there and read a couple of verses out of that as we prepare to close. Isaiah 46. Here God is speaking about the idols of Babylon. He's comparing himself to the idols. And he's talking about how here they're fastened, they're put in place, they do not speak, they do not hear, they do not see, they can't do anything, and yet you're bowing down before them and worshiping them. And he says in verse 8, remember this and stand firm, recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. These idols are not God. I alone, he says, I am God. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning. Again, not talking about the minutiae, not talking about every detail from the very beginning, that he had all the details of the forthcoming history already put in place. No, not at all. But he declares the end. In other words, where he's taking history, I have declared it. I've done so from the beginning and from ancient times, things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purpose. Ultimately, what that means is that God will accomplish his purpose, his ultimate purpose, and that is not only restoring creation to what it was, but bringing it to its ultimate destiny, the new creation, a new heaven and new earth. And that's what that's how he's moving history. So this does not mean, again, that God micromanages all the details of history. It does mean that every thought and every action of every human being, it is not decreed, as some people would tell us, from the foundation of the world. Not at all. It means rather that God is sovereign even over a substantially free creation. That he arranges, orders, and manages major events of the unfolding of time in order to bring creation to its divinely ordained goal. And that goal, of course, is the appearance of the children of God, at which time creation will be restored. And in the process of time, as God continues to work with his children who now are in familial relationship with him, now made immortal and are like Jesus Christ, will bring about a new heaven and a new earth wherein dwells righteousness, a righteousness that will endure for all eternity. Well, that's what we're looking for, the end of the matter. So when we see the world in the condition that it's in, when we see evil seemingly unrestrained in these days in which we live, remember, there's a sovereign God who's in control of it all. He lets things happen, but then he removes the restraints. He adds the restraints. Ultimately, he will bring it to the conclusion he desires, and he invites you and I to be a part of it.